Case number 23-1091. Consumers Research et al. Petitioners versus Federal Communications Commission and United States of America. Mr. Kelson for the petitioners, Mr. Carr for the respondents.
Money.
May it please the court, Jared Kelson for petitioners. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes. Each year, the FCC passively authorizes the collection of billions of dollars for telecommunication services from telecommunication carriers from their customers and their customers for the Universal Service Fund. That money is then used to subsidize telecommunication services across the United States. The amount dwarfs the annual appropriation for the FCC many times over. To give perspective, the Universal Service Fund budget for the second quarter of 2023, at issue in this case, was $1.95 billion, which alone was roughly four times the FCC's appropriation for the whole year. This funding mechanism is categorically unique, and it's premised on vague definitions of universal service and universal service principles, which the FCC and numerous courts have concluded are aspirational only. As Judge Newsom recently wrote, they provide no meaningful constraint but confer frontline and law and policymaking power on the agency. Such unbounded authority violates the non-delegation doctrine.
Since you mentioned Judge Newsom's opinion, can we start there?
Sure.
And particularly on the private non-delegation issue. He said that USAC has little actual discretion because all the contribution calculating formulas are fixed by FCC regulation. Do you have a reason why you think he was not correct about that?
I think that the guidance that is given by the FCC to USAC still allows significant discretion to determine the amount of money to be appropriated.
What areas do they exercise discretion over?
Well, for example, the USAC is the entity that makes the grants in the first place. So they're projecting how much they're going to be allotting to the different entities. So even within the guidelines that the FCC has set forth, USAC still has discretion about where they're going to be appropriating the money.
So USAC, are you talking about the decision about, okay, we should spend a total of, let's say, $10 billion this year? Or are you talking about, okay, like this particular carrier should contribute this amount of money?
My understanding of,
what do you think USAC? You said USAC does this. Which of those two?
USAC is looking at the grants it expects to be making in the upcoming quarter and using that to calculate.
Oh, so you're talking about disbursements.
Well, my understanding from the FCC's position is that the way that this is limited is they look at the disbursements they anticipate, and then they create a budget, and that USAC sends that budget to the FCC, and the FCC ministerially calculates what contribution factor will be necessary to provide that money to USAC for the grants.
And Judge Newsom's separate opinion said he thinks that USAC's hands are tied, I think, in everything you just described, particularly in deciding the total amount of disbursements that should be made. So is he wrong?
I think if were the case, we would disagree with that.
Okay.
If that were the case,
like the Missouri show me state, like show me where I can look to and see Judge Newsom was wrong about that.
There's nothing in the guidelines that tells USAC who to give the money to or how much to give to each entity. To the extent that those guidelines or that those regulations limit the total amount that USAC can collect, there's still a significant amount of discretion that USAC has to operate within that world. I think the most unique aspect of this situation
there's regulations that say it has to be proportionately distributed and everyone should only have to carry their equal share. So that seems like a pretty significant limitation on what they charge each person. I think it's just math. They're just doing the math and dividing it up.
So those terms are necessarily vague. What equitable is a vague term. The fact that the contribution factor is fluctuating so much each quarter is evidence that there's a lot of discretion that's going into play here.
I think that shows discretion. I sometimes just shows math numbers change, and so math calculations change. I mean, do they have the ability to say, hey, I really like you, Company X. I'm not going to give you any charge this month. And I really hate you, Company Y. I had terrible service with you a few years ago. I'm going to triple up what you have to pay. Is there that kind of discretion you're talking about?
I think that USAC has the ability to discern where it decides that the need is, and then to allocate the funds accordingly. There's an appeal process on the back
end. So he can't do what I said. That type of discretion in the calculation. There's the regulator.
As far as I'm aware, that sort of who you like and who you don't.
Which is count, is who not does, who has to count
the much. Regulations. Who has to pay how much?
They can't do it in any way other than mathematical fact.
According to the contribution factor, is that the question?
What I'm asking you is when they do the math and then figure out who. Here's our contribution factor. Now that means this company owes this and this company owes that much.
That part is based on the revenues.
Right, so that's not discretionary.
No, well, no, it is not. It's getting to the contribution.
Sorry, I still don't understand.
It's getting to the contribution factor where the problem is. I think the biggest indication that there's a non-delegation issue here is
what is the contribution?
In this case, it's 29%.
No, but can you define it? Like, so I think there's a decision is made for, let's say, the first quarter mm-hmm. that universal service will require $4 billion.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's not the contribution rate, right?
That's not the contribution rate.
Okay. The contribution rate is in order to reach $4 billion this quarter, we're going to need to take out a certain amount of money from each carrier. And that rate that decides what each carrier will pay is the contribution rate? This is a question.
That's correct.
Okay. And who takes a first shot at deciding what the contribution rate is? USAC or FCC?
The contribution rate is calculated by the Office of the Managing Director at the FCC. But that calculation is a ministerial calculation based upon projections, based on how USAC projects its budget and expects to send its budget. So
it seems to me, and I don't think that this necessarily hurts you, that although the contribution rate is kind of probably being decided by the FCC itself, the contribution rate is going to be based on the total amount of funds that universal service requires for that quarter.
Correct.
And the decision on what the total amount of funds for universal service requires, that first cut decision is being made by USAC.
That is correct.
I'm going to ask the FCC if they, he's nodding yes. So.
I apologize if I misunderstood your question earlier, but that is a correct explanation.
And then that leads to the question, you know, let's say that USAC said, well, last quarter it was $4 billion, but we think this quarter it should be $4.5 billion. Is it possible that could be wrong? Is there a reg that you would compare that to? What standard is USAC making that decision?
I think they're making it according to these general ideas about universal service. I think the important thing to recognize here is that quarterly contribution factor, which is calculated based on USAC's projections, is subsequently deemed approved by the FCC if it takes no action within 14 days. Okay. And that is, I think, is the crux of this problem, is that the FCC is rubber stamping these things through.
Maybe you just answered this, but it makes sense that the FCC would rubber stamp it if USAC isn't really bound by FCC specific guidance. But if USAC is bound by FCC specific guidance and they got out of line, then, you know, FCC would kind of crack down on that. And your point, I think, is that the FCC has not given them specific guidance on what you're calling it the contribution factor. I'm going to call it the total amount of money that's spent that quarter. You're saying FCC has not given them specific guidance about that.
About the total budget, projected budget. That is correct.
I want to ask them FCC about that too.
So what's vague about universal service? This phrase has been around for 90 years. Do we know what's vague? You keep saying these things are vague. What's vague about it? What's unconstitutionally vague about it?
So I think that first off, as an initial cut, the term universal service has no sort of objective limitation. It's a very open-ended, vague phrase that is left to the discretion of the agency to define.
Unconstitutional when universal service was implemented by the program with AT&T?
Are you talking before the 1996
Act? Yes. That was implementing, collecting money to subsidize, to provide universal service. Was that an unconstitutional delegation to AT&T, a private entity?
I think that the situation was different back then because
it was different, but was it an unconstitutional delegation because universal service is too vague?
It did. What I'm saying is that it did not raise the same non-delegation issues.
Why? If universal service is vague and unknowable, why wouldn't it?
Because at the time, those decisions were being made in the private market. I think
what was being made in the private market? What, universal services? That would seem to be Congress delegated to private market. I don't know why you wouldn't have a delegation problem there. I mean, this phrase has been around for a long, long time, including through that period, and I didn't see any delegation challenges when the private entity AT&T was imposing costs on users, certain users, to fund other users to obtain universal service.
Prior to 1906, a significant portion of the universal service program was prices that were being set by the FCC itself. And that was allowed for the cross subsidization. It was a totally different regime than we have now.
I want to get back to my question again. You said universal. The problem here is the term universal service is vague. That doesn't impose limits. It was vague even under the AT&T scheme?
It was vague under the AT&T standard. The mechanism which was being implemented was different
than
which gets started.
Why wasn't that an unconstitutional delegation? If you said it doesn't matter if it's FCC or AT&T, that was trying to figure out what it meant and how much to collect. I don't understand why your argument wouldn't equally indict that program.
To the extent universal service was being implemented by private companies, it does not implicate the non-delegation doctrine.
I'm sorry, but if it's doing so under the direction of the FCC for delegation from Congress, this may just be my thickness, but I don't understand why, under your theory of non-delegation, maybe you think FCC rode tighter herd on AT&T, but that doesn't answer the non-delegation question. There's nothing more specific for Congress than there is here on universal service, right?
To the extent the FCC had the same discretion under the old program, it would have raised similar concerns, yes.
Did they have the same discretion?
I believe so.
Okay. It just seems odd. This thing's been around for almost 100 years, and someone now is just challenging.
Well, the mechanism by which the FCC was implementing it didn't extract money. And right in this case, we're...
Wait. It most certainly did. It imposed essentially a fee or a tax, however you want to describe it, on urban customers to subsidize customers who were rural or yet didn't have access to service. Am I misunderstanding?
The old system was based upon price fixing by the FCC that set standardized rates. It wasn't about introducing some sort of tax or fee that would then extract money from some consumers and give it to an agency to redistribute.
So am I wrong in my understanding that the way it worked was AT&T would impose an additional charge on, for example, urban consumers of their telephone service and use that money, give the FCC, to provide service, subsidized service by AT&T to non-urban customers? I could be completely wrong.
My understanding of the old system is the FCC was setting rates across the board, that it wasn't setting fees that were tacked on and then that were cross-subsidizing.
Was there more direction from Congress as to what those rates should be to accomplish universal service? Was there any more direction from Congress, or was there less?
I am not entirely sure, but I think that there was probably less.
Alrighty.
It would still raise the same concerns.
May I ask, I'm just trying to understand the implications of your private delegation arguments. So the Medicare program uses private insurance companies, generally called fiscal intermediaries, although I think they've changed the name recently, but I'm going to use fiscal intermediaries to do endless calculations, computations, and determinations of the amounts of people are going to get for Medicare, to hear their appeals, and to even make initial decisions on challenges. Is that an unconstitutional private delegation too? Because they actually get to hear the first round appeal of a challenge to a disbursement. We have an adjudicatory role, which doesn't happen here. Is that unconstitutional too, under your theory?
I can't claim to be an expert on the Medicare regime that Congress has implemented. What I can offer is that this court and U.S. Telecom made pretty clear that an agency can't simply rubber stamp the actions of private entities, that they have to independently exercise their reviewing authority and come to their own conclusion.
Okay, but that So is your, I'm just trying to understand your argument. Is your, so your private non-delegation argument is nothing more than a rubber stamp one. Otherwise, it was perfectly fine if we actually were to find record evidence that the FCC has in fact reviewed and altered USAC determinations. Or do you, it's, I had thought there was more to it. I had thought it was sort of a, it was not just that, but it was also too much delegation from Congress and then diluted even further by delegating to private entities. But am I wrong?
The private non-delegation issue here is aggravated by the fact that the delegation from Congress has been so vague. But to finely tune exactly, I think, the question to your answer, the deemed approved RET mechanism is unconstitutional. If the FCC had independently reviewed the data before
they're deeming approved a number that they calculated. They're not deeming approved a number that USAC provided. They're deeming approved, it's kind of weird, but they deem approved a number that the FCC calculated. So how is that improper?
Because the number that the FCC calculated incorporated wholesale a projection from a private entity that was not reviewed. There's no evidence in the record that the FCC looked at the budget projections, that they agreed with them, that they made that determination on their own, and then used that to calculate the contribution factor. Instead, they've offloaded that function to a private entity who looks at...
Okay, so under your theory, though, then CMS, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, is going to have to go back and double-check the math of every fiscal intermediary on every computation they do for every Medicare recipient in this country. Otherwise, it will be rubber stamping.
I'm very hesitant to express expertise on the Medicaid regime.
You don't have to have expertise. I'm not an expert on it either, but this is what happens. Fiscal intermediaries, it's what they do. They're intermediaries. They make the first round determinations, and they can be appealed. Of course, the first appeal is decided by the intermediary, and then that can be appealed to CMS. And so my question is it required that they go back and check the math? That seems to be what you're arguing here, that they need to go back and check the math and computations of USAC in order to avoid this private non-delegation problem.
That is correct. The FCC must review.
And so the implications of your argument are going to reach pretty far into other.
I think that there are 40 years of precedent saying that rubber stamping is unconstitutional.
What case do you have in mind that holds that? So the idea being, assume that the FCC's review authority here is just purely formal. You know, just going back to cases like Adkins, the problem before was a private entity was imposing and enacting binding regulations, and the fix was give the agency authority to reject or modify that. There wasn't a further inquiry into how often the agency modified what the private entity was doing. So what is there a case that actually engages in that type of analysis?
So, I mean, I would start back with, for example, with the Sierra Club case that we cited, but up to, like, for example, in 2004, in this court's decision in U.S. Telecom, the court said that agencies may seek advice and recommendations from outside parties, but they may not rubber stamp decisions made by others under the guise of seeking their advice. I think that asking someone for, like, their computations, for their assessment of data, it would fall under that broad category. Otherwise, it would allow, like, the point is that someone here is exercising authority that is affecting the private rights of U.S. citizens, and the agency is taking that face value, rubber stamping it through, and it's imposing significant burdens on members of society. Under the Constitution, the agency has to make that decision.
How do you define private rights? You just referenced private rights. This is a heavily regulated industry that operates under a license from the FCC. They have no right to engage in telecommunications without that license. So help define private rights for me.
I think, at least in this case, the ability to impose fees on a marketplace would implicate their pocketbook.
It can't be just this case. Are you bringing an as-applied challenge?
Well, we are only challenging the FCC's program here.
Are you bringing an as-applied challenge or a facial challenge to the non-delegation?
We're bringing an as-applied challenge to the 2023 second quarter contribution factor. And as part of that challenge, this court's precedent and others allow the parties to raise challenges to the underlying statutory and constitutional authority of the agencies to act.
And so you're not, how would one write an opinion in this case that would find an as-applied error here without taking down the entire scheme? How would you write that?
This court's opinion only needs to address the 2023
second quarter. No. That's just not how these things work. All right. If we were to, what is peculiar? I know you say in your reply brief, well, they didn't change the numbers from USAC this time, but that doesn't show rubber stamp. If we're only looking at this one quarter, you can't prove rubber stamping. You have no capacity. All your arguments about rubber stamping in your brief cover long periods of time. But you're telling us now to only look at the single event, at which point we have no basis for finding rubber stamping. So I'm very confused as to this.
The very nature of a deemed approved program suggests or is indicative of rubber stamping.
But the very nature sounds like a facial challenge to me.
The fact that the FCC has committed the same violation in other contexts may be true, and this court's decision may have implications for other quarters, which the FCC has considered.
There's nothing as applied. I'm trying to figure out legally what is, because normally in an as applied constitutional challenge, one says, look, could be perfectly constitutional as applied all these other times. But there's something about these peculiar facts in this case. That's what as applied is. I didn't read your argument to say all these other times, these other quarters, that can be perfectly constitutional, but there's something special about this quarter. And if I've misunderstood your argument, please help me to understand what is special about this quarter that creates a constitutional problem that other quarters in the scheme overall would not.
All I can offer the court is what happened in this quarter. It may have implications for others, but looking about the facts
of the quarter
challenge.
What happened in this quarter that's special, that's unique, constitutionally unique?
The specific numbers and the contribution factor at issue are a unique application. That's what gave the parties standing to sue. That's what brought them before this court. If this court's decision has implications for other quarters, that suggests a broader problem. But all I can offer the court is that in this case, that there is no evidence in the record whatsoever that the commissioners actually reviewed the contribution factor, that they reviewed the projections by USAC, and that they came to their own independent determination that those were appropriate.
And so it's rubber stamping, because if it turned out that every other year of this program, they had reviewed them, and 50% of the time they'd made some tweaks or changes, 50% of the time they hadn't needed to, and then you come here and pick out one quarter and say, aha, this is one they didn't need to, ergo rubber stamping, is that a plausible argument?
I think it is a possible argument, given the fact that there's no evidence in this record that the FCC reviewed this that the FCC commissioners reviewed this contribution factor or the underlying
projections. Is there evidence that they didn't? I mean, we assume that agencies fulfill their legal, that's our starting assumption, that agencies have properly executed their duties under the law and constitution. So what evidence is there that they haven't?
Well, when the petitioners raised the possibility that there were problems here, the FCC provided no additional evidence that the commissioners had done that review.
Okay, so absence of evidence does not mean a burden of proof.
If Your Honor is looking for additional proof beyond that, then the history of the FCC not reviewing this.
Which is a facial challenge. Okay. You raised these exact same challenges in a number of other circuits and laws. Why do you not face issue preclusion raising those same arguments again in this court, since you haven't yet been able to identify anything peculiar to this quarter?
Every time that the commission acts, it raises a new injury, and the parties are able to bring a challenge to that injury to the court.
Go ahead. I do have enough. If you were to prevail here under the legal principles you're asserting, do you have a sense of how many other federal programs would, by that principle, be unconstitutional delegations?
I'm not aware of any other program that deems approved calculations that are wholly dependent upon the findings of private parties. So I can't point to any.
Here. Go ahead.
I thought when I get my pay stub Medicare, there's like a tax that percent. I think Congress has picked how much taxes I pay to Medicare.
No, these are claims by hospitals for reimbursements for services provided.
Well, I think on the disbursement side, there may be similarities with a lot of programs. I thought your main argument was on the contribution side. Not who gets money.
Right.
Who has money taken away from.
Yes, and the assessments against.
And I think what your answer to me was, this is an outlier program.
Yes, I am not aware of any other agency that derives its funds especially multiple times its own agency budget from private parties based on these projections by private entities.
There's a CFPB case in front of the Supreme Court. They heard oral arguments already. They haven't issued the decision. It has to do with CFPB kind of raising, sort of determining its, arguably allegedly determining its own budget. Assume CFPB wins that case. Are you familiar with the case?
I'm generally familiar.
Okay. If CFPB wins that case, does that hurt your argument here?
The CFPB's funding is pegged to a statutory percentage that Congress has provided. There's no statutory percentage here. So that's the easiest distinction.
What's the most sort of outlandish, expansive program that you think FCC or USAC, put aside a distinction for now, could call an aspect of universal service? And then I'm going to ask the government whether they think the statute allows the FCC to do.
Well, as far as the statute goes?
Yeah, a lot of your argument and part of your discussion with Judge Millett was whether universal service is a clearly defined, easily knowable concept, or whether it's so vague that, you know, the FCC could say, you know, have to fund a missile defense system as part of universal service in order to protect everyone's internet from getting, you know, bombed or something. I think that would be outlandish. That would not be part of universal service. So my question for you is, what's the most extreme thing the FCC could do that would still be within the statutory concept of universal service?
I don't know that I'm prepared to say what the most extreme is, but there has been public discourse about whether or not the FCC can extend charges to video streaming services to fund the Universal Service Fund.
Video streaming services? Oh, so like Netflix or...
That's my understanding.
And then, so the idea is maybe they would say rural areas, we need urban areas to pay the cost of rural areas getting Netflix.
The FCC has already expanded voice analog services to broadband or telecommunication services, which originally were voice analog services, now to have broadband communication or broadband internet. So the point is that if the FCC determines that something that has broad discretion to redefine universal service, to define what is encompassed within universal service, and it keeps reaching further and further. If you look at the history of this program, the universal service fee, the quarterly contribution rate started out around.
Right. No, I got it.
Now
it's huge. Okay. Let me go to Rural Cellular 2.
Okay.
And that opinion says, number one, this is not a tax. And number two, there's an intelligible principle. The government won that case. Mm-hmm. If our court had said the opposite of those two statements, or let's just take the second statement. If our court had said the opposite of there is an intelligible principle, had instead said there is not an intelligible principle for this delegation, the government would have lost the case because it would have been an unconstitutional delegation, right? I don't think that's debatable.
Correct.
Okay. So I think that means it was a holding and we're bound by it, because I think that a test for a holding is if the court could say the opposite of a statement and the judgment would be the same, fine, that's dicta. But if the court saying the opposite of a statement would by necessity change the judgment in the case, that's a holding. Maybe that's an overly simplistic test for holding versus dicta, but what do you think of that test?
I think that in Rural Cellular 2, the parties had not argued.
Well,
but you just want a question on the
table. Yeah, just in general legal principles. And I'll give you a chance to talk specifically about Rural Cellular 2, but
I think that is.
I think my test for holding and dicta is a good test. It wouldn't be just applicable in this case, it would be applicable in every case we decide forever.
I think that the test would require a little more nuance. Sometimes after the court has already resolved the case, it goes on to add additional factors or make additional statements that are not necessary to resolve it, even if they could have on their own.
But here it was, I mean, it was necessary to say whether the federal action was constitutional or not, because if it had been unconstitutional, the government would have had to lose that case.
Correct. The problem is that in Rural Cellular 2, the parties hadn't actually briefed a non-delegation problem under the intelligible principle test. They had focused purely on a clear statement rule. The Supreme Court in McCutcheon said pretty clearly that.
I remember the McCutcheon quote. I thought it was a good quote. It's helpful for you. I think stare decisis here works. Our version of horizontal stare decisis works differently than the Supreme Court's version of horizontal stare decisis. Supreme Court always sits the equivalent of en banc, so they're always at liberty to overrule one of their holdings. I think a three-judge panel here is not at liberty to overrule a three-judge panel precedent. So I'm not sure the McCutcheon quote gets you all the way there.
The petitioner's position in this case is that the arguments were not raised in that case and that the party should not be foreclosed from raising them here. If this panel determines that Rural Cellular 2, that the statement about the non-delegation doctrine was a holding, then that would resolve the first issue in this case.
What would it be? Because the argument there was an unconstitutional delegation of the taxing power. And the first thing, of course, well, it wasn't a tax, it was a fee. But that wouldn't answer whether it was an unconstitutional delegation of the taxing power. We just say it was a fee. And then the court said, in any event, there's an intelligible principle here. So there are two alternative holdings, right? I mean, you say the second one wasn't necessary, but there were two alternative holdings.
I think that's a friendly question to you.
Well, the fact that they were alternative holding means the second one was not necessary.
Not under our circuit precedent. We're quite clear that there's two alternative holdings for a ruling. They're both binding on another panel.
Then again, I would just raise the fact that the arguments that the parties never argued the intelligible principle test. They were arguing about a clear statement rule. And so the court was not faced with
the court in the process, because you've done excellent briefing in this case, but both sides, sometimes we don't always get the best briefing, but there are actually questions embedded in legal questions presented to us that are necessary for us to resolve to decide the case. And at least I'm not aware of a principle that says if they didn't brief it, but the court determined it necessary to make a holding, it no longer has stare decisis effect. For every stare decisis case, we have to go back and read the briefs. Is that right?
I think that if the parties raise that proposition and can point to where in the briefs it was missing, that
for every stare decisis case, I have to go back and read the briefs in that case. I can't trust the panel.
I think when the issue was not raised by the parties, I think that it raises the possibility.
Even if the court thought it was necessary to determine.
If this court determines that was a binding holding, then that would resolve the issue.
If the court thought it was necessary to resolve, even though the briefing wasn't all
that good. I think that if the court had gone into some sort of significant discussion about why it satisfied the intelligible principle test,
so the question discussion wasn't long enough.
It was a one sentence passing reference after the court had already.
It was in any event holding. So if we deem it as an alternative, it's not a tax, and in any event, which is usually how any event is used, there's an intelligible principle. So even if it were a tax, it would be an intelligible principle guiding it here. So that's not just loose commentary.
Under this circuit's prior panel rule, if you determine that was a holding that abides this panel, then that would resolve the issue.
All my questions were asked.
I'm sorry.
No, that's great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time. We'll give you some time on rebuttal. Mr. Carr.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is James Carr, and I represent the Federal Communications Commission. Let me start with Rural Cellular 2. Just so you understand the background of that case, the petitioners in that case were making an argument under the Supreme Court's decision in NCTA that there needed to be a narrowing construction of Section 254. Their position was that the FCC's reading of Section 254 in that case would have resulted in an unconstitutional delegation. They argued that to avoid that, that situation, the court, under the doctrine of constitutional avoidance, should adopt petitioner's reading of Section 254. The commission in its brief responded in a couple of ways. First, it said, this isn't a tax, so it doesn't get involved with the whole issue of taxing. But more importantly, regardless, the commission's interpretation doesn't raise constitutional issues because there is an intelligible principle in the statute. So the parties did brief, to some extent, the intelligible principle test. The commission specifically raised it. And the court, in Judge Ginsburg's opinion, addressed both issues. First, saying this wasn't a tax. Second, even if it was, under the Supreme Court's Skinner decision, the same intelligible principle test applies to taxing delegations as to all other delegations.
Can I ask you some questions along the lines of what I was asking the petitioner? I think if I remember right, universal service includes fast internet for schools.
It does include internet access for schools and libraries. That's correct.
So, and I assume that if the internet service moved at the speed of mud, you know, like in the 1998 days of, you know, dial up, that would probably not be good enough for the schools.
I think that's right, Your Honor. The universal service guarantee, as Judge Pillard noted in the 2018 AT&T decision, is dynamic, and therefore the commission takes account of technological changes.
Who decides, when it comes to internet for schools, who decides how fast is fast enough? Is it the FCC or is it USAC?
Well, the FCC would make policy judgments regarding the kinds of service that would be provided to the schools and what would be suitable. It's also important to recognize, Your Honor, there are extensive rules and regulations governing the schools and libraries program that require each entity that's receiving discounted service to put out for competitive bidding to all providers the possibility of providing service, and then to select the most cost-effective provider.
And you may not know this, there's no reason to know this off the top of your head, but would it be possible to find out which FCC regulation says the internet service to the schools has to be, you know, a certain speed?
There may well be a regulation. I don't know off the top of my head that there's a regulation that specifies the amount of
what
speed.
About what is what counts as universal service?
Yes.
Does the statute answer that?
I think the statute does answer that, Your Honor, and I think you have to read the statute. The intelligible principle case law talks about how you don't just read the text of the statute in isolation. You look at the context. You look at the purpose of the statute, the underlying factual background. That's been the test for many decades, and this court has repeatedly applied that test. So here, in 1996, Congress decided to open up local telecommunications markets to competition. As a result, the existing universal service program couldn't go on as it had before because it relied largely on implicit subsidies.
What statutory standard would a court review if someone said the FCC has deemed something part of universal service, but we don't think it's part of universal service?
Well, I think what you would look at is
254C talks about the definition of universal service, and it says that it is an evolving level of telecommunication services. So there's one limit right away. It's got to be a telecommunication service in order to qualify under Section 254C1.
Would a free cell phone for everyone in rural America be a telecommunication service?
That would go more to equipment than to service. I think that raises an interesting question.
Could that be part of universal service?
That raises an interesting question. I think the commission, before it decided to authorize that sort of thing, would have to consider, among other things, the cost of providing that. And we've talked about that in the brief, that affordability.
The answer is maybe.
I suppose it's maybe, but it is. But again, Your Honor, it's subject to judicial review. The question here, remember,
what would we be reviewing? By what standard would we be reviewing that?
Well, you'd be reviewing the court talked about the standard under Rural Cellular 1 and AT&T, that the commission can't just allow the system to grow unchecked, because if it does, it creates affordability problems for the people who are paying for the subsidies.
You would want an Article 3 judge to be deciding that economics question?
Well, under the standards provided in the statute, affordability, you could see a situation.
Wouldn't a court just say a service is a product? Service and products are different?
It could, yes. That's right, Your Honor. It could certainly say that.
Has the FCC thus far required, I don't have any idea, required the provision of iPads in every school?
No.
It's the provision of any equipment other than the stuff that's needed, the wires and stuff.
It's required internal connections and it's required internet access. So it's required the transmission, but it hasn't required iPads or other facilities.
Now, satellite internet service, a service, telecommunication service, internet.
Satellite service is different from telecommunication service, as I understand it, Your Honor. So
the FCC could not say enough, we're going to use universal service to bring satellite internet service to all of rural America.
I don't think so, Your Honor. No.
There's a definition of telecommunications.
There is a definition of telecommunications service in the statute. That's right, Your Honor. And that would limit the commission's discretion in choosing how to define universal service. I think also in Section 254C1, there are various factors that the commission has to consider. Again, taking into account technological developments. And the court has found that this is perfectly reasonable statutory provision. It's meant to show that the guarantee of universal service is dynamic, so that it changes over time in response to the adoption of technology. So, for example, in 1934, when the commission was concerned about promoting universal service, people were using rotary telephones. And nowadays, most people aren't using landline phones at all. They're using wireless phones. And so the commission has made a transition over time to promoting mobile telephony and broadband service, which are the more...
You mentioned the possibility of funding Netflix for rural America. Is it conceivable that could be part of universal service?
That's a trickier question, Your Honor, because it's not clear to me, again, that falls within telecommunications service under Section 254C1.
What about the question of how much money is needed to fund universal service? Ask the petitioner this. And
yes,
I think that first cut of how much money is needed to fund universal service is made by USAC. Is that correct?
It is, but again, subject to FCC rules. I think this notion that somehow USAC is free to make these spending decisions.
Can you kind of describe in layman's term what the rules on the front end are that USAC?
Sure, Your Honor. And we've listed some of the rules in footnotes 19 through 21 of the brief. First of all, you have eligibility requirements. So carriers cannot receive universal service funding unless they meet the eligibility requirements. There are requirements for high-cost funding, have to be an eligible telecommunications carrier as designated by a state commission. There are requirements for schools and libraries and rural telephone funding, or I'm sorry, rural healthcare funding, where parties have to show that they've put out for competitive bidding their request for service and that they've identified a provider that is cost effective, among other things. So there's a very formal process. So USAC is not at liberty to start handing out money to those who are not eligible. And the projections have to take account of eligibility. They also have to take account of there are certain caps, limits on funding.
This is my question. Don't the regulations specify the amount of funding? Not in dollar amounts, but the method for calculating the amount that each eligible carrier can receive.
They do, Your Honor. That was the third point I was moving to. That there are for individual elements of universal service, and we talk about some of those regulations in footnote 21. You have specific formulas for calculating the amount of discounts that schools and libraries receive, or the amount of subsidies received by rural healthcare providers. And in addition, there are caps on funding. There's an annual cap on rural health care funding, an annual cap on schools and libraries funding, a per line limit.
And that's all by FCC regulation.
All by FCC regulation. And so USAC's projections have to take account of all of those rules.
When deciding how much total money is needed for universal service, does USAC need to exercise judgment?
If it is exercising any judgment under the FCC's rules, if there's any question about how the rules were to apply, USAC is directed to come to the commission and make inquiries about if there's some ambiguity about it, how a rule would apply. USAC is...
As you're describing, they would at least kind of have to make judgment about whether they have to make judgment.
Well,
yes, then they would go to the FCC.
Yes, but it's also important to keep in mind, Your Honor, that the adoption of the contribution factor is not the end of the review process either. USAC decisions are subject to appeal, so that if an aggrieved party thought that USAC made the wrong decision, misapplied an FCC rule, it could appeal the USAC decision to the FCC. And we've pointed to some situations where the FCC has, in fact, granted relief, reversed USAC.
With regard to the total amount of money that USAC takes a first cut at deciding will be spent for universal service that quarter, is it correct to say that FCC's active involvement is rare?
I think that probably is fair to say. And again, Your Honor, I think that's largely because USAC is already confined by FCC. So typically when USAC is making its projections, those accurately reflect, yes.
Your involvement isn't rare. Your involvement is there.
It's there.
There all the time.
It's rare in the sense that there haven't been that many changes. At the stage where there is a deemed approval, where the projections
right.
come
set
ahead,
out the guardrails,
but the guardrails are already there. That's right, and the commission's intervention is not non-existent because there have been cases, and in fact, twice in 2023, the commission actually said we're not going to take USAC's projections at face value. There are some unused funds from previous quarters. We're going to roll them into the numbers.
I understand that. And I think that you said earlier, and this would be good for you, that if USAC just said we're going to triple the budget of the universal service for the next quarter, so much so that it might be 100% of carriers' revenues, you know, that would be... USAC couldn't do that. That would be contrary to regulation or contrary to statute.
It would certainly be contrary to regulations. I think it would also
would it be contrary to statute.
It would essentially be contrary to statute in the sense that, again, when you're talking about the basic concept of universal service. The goal, which has been the goal of Congress and the FCC since 1934, has been to try to maximize the number of subscribers in the United States who are on the telephone network, who have access to reliable, affordable telephone service.
So if FCC were to bless that, then someone could challenge that and a court would say, that's contrary to statute. Because
it would be inconsistent with the goal of universal service, and it would drive people off the
net. Can I run through, I've got about six, seven things. Some of them may be products, not services, so you can, that may be easy answers, but if it's conceivable, it could be part of universal service.
Okay.
Phone landlines, I think yes.
Landline service is definitely included.
Cell service, cellular phone service?
Yes, it's
fast wired internet. Could it be? Not is it?
Internet service for schools and libraries
already exists.
Could
fast wired internet service to rural America also be part of universal service under the statute?
Well, again, that would depend in part on whether that service is classified as a telecommunications service. As the court may well be aware, that subject is a rather fraught subject, and there is considerable disagreement about that within the commission. So it's possible. It's possible.
Or maybe, or reasonable people would disagree with each other.
Yes.
A cellular flip phone for,
You're talking about providing the phones, that again would probably not be, because it's not a product as opposed to a service.
Okay. And then what about funding for private research on rocket launching technology so that bringing satellite internet to rural America would eventually become cheap? The statute.
That's a really interesting hypothetical, Your Honor. And not something that had ever occurred to me, but I don't. I think that's well beyond what would be considered under universal service.
What if Congress said we're going to abolish all current taxes and we're going to authorize the IRS to calculate how much money the government needs for all of its current programs, and the IRS will compel contributions from every American until the budget is met? Would that be an unconstitutional delegation?
Again, it would depend on whether an intelligible principle has been applied. As the way you've described it, I don't think there is an intelligible principle there. I know what these petitioners have argued is that somehow
the principle would be this currently exist, and the IRS will decide how much. They'll just do the math. They'll do some fact finding how much money needs to be raised, and then they'll assess contributions.
Again, it's there has to be some sort of specific guidance when it comes to what policies are they considering. The universal service program here is different from that scenario in the sense that, for one thing, there was a long history. For 60 years, there had been a universal service program when Section 254 was passed. And that history informs the way you read the statute. And
let me ask
it's
about another program with a long history. Judge Millett mentioned Medicare.
Medicare, sure.
And I understood, I could be wrong, that the discussion to be primarily about Medicare spending disbursements rather than revenue collection.
That's my understanding, too.
Do you think that Congress could, instead of setting the tax rate for Medicare withholding that I see on my pay stub every year, they could abolish that and just say to CMCS, you decide how much money needs to be raised each year for Medicare?
If Congress did that, it would have to give more specific policy guidance to Medicare, to the HHS, as to how to determine those numbers, in the same way that Congress in this statute, in Section 254, laid out specific principles.
There's about six principles here: equitable, non-discriminatory,
affordability. Reasonable comparability.
So, with those six principles, then Congress could give CMCS those six principles and say, you decide how much money needs to be raised for Medicare each year.
It's possible. The devil is in the details. But again, this system, And I know there's a suggestion, that the petitioners have made that somehow if this is upheld, that that sort of approach is going to sweep the government. Well, this statute has been in place for 25 years, and it remains, as these petitioners can say, unique.
Let's say you were to lose this case. Do you think it would bring down any other government programs with it?
It's possible. I just don't know, Your Honor. I don't know enough about.
And I'm so grateful to my colleagues for being so patient with my questions. But who do you think are the primary beneficiaries of universal service? Do you think it's customers or carriers?
Well, the both of them benefit. I guess if you're talking about the primary beneficiaries, and this is consistent with what Judge Ginsburg found in Rural Cellular 2, that carriers benefit from the expansion of universal service, the expansion of the network, because
Judge Brown in Rural Cellular 1 said that the customers were the primary beneficiaries, but
well,
maybe they disagree with each other. You agree with Judge Ginsburg.
The truth of the matter is, Your Honor, that this issue about whether it's a fee or a tax is a frolic and detour here. It doesn't matter, because under Skinner, the Supreme Court has made clear the same test applies to taxing delegations as to all other delegations. That's the intelligible principle test. And it's our position that this court has already decided that issue in Rural Cellular 2. And that precedent.
Taxing means you're taking money from Peter to pay Paul. And traditionally, that decision is made by Congress. Right? And had been made by Parliament, you know, shortly, forever after they executed Charles I.
That's certainly what the petitioners are arguing. The Supreme Court has found
that. You think it's a general principle, it's fine for Congress to delegate to agencies. How much money will be taken from Peter in order to pay Paul?
I think the Supreme Court has said in Skinner that a delegation is permissible. And it pointed out that it may well be that Congress, in delegating that sort of authority, should be especially circumspect about doing so. But it also said that level of prudence is not required by the Constitution.
Because it's still Congress that passes the statute that says this is how we're going to do our taxing, right?
Yes. That is correct.
So as to hypotheticals about rockets and things like that, am I correct that the statute itself not only defines telecommunications services, but says for something to qualify as a universal service in section 254C that it has to be through the operation of market choices by customers, been subscribed to by a substantial majority of residential customers, and been deployed in a public telecommunications networks by telecommunication carriers.
That's right, Your Honor. And that
happened for rockets yet?
No, of course not. And the point there is, this again is the emphasis, that it's not just about the FCC funding any new technology that comes down the pike.
Statutory definitions and limitations,
yes,
in addition to your regulations. Congress can just throw open the doors here and say,
absolutely. Absolutely.
To make it right.
And the commission is bound to consider those factors when it decides to change the definition of universal service. And those considerations basically go to not just the evolution of technology, but the evolution of the marketplace. So that, for example, when Americans start abandoning their wireline phones and using more wireless phones, it makes sense. Congress recognized this. It makes sense for the commission to shift its universal service efforts to promoting mobile telephony.
I had just one on. I know you say it doesn't matter if it's a tax or a fee, but on the other hand, we as courts would want to be extra careful.
Sure.
About that line. We want Congress to, and I'm struggling with understanding how you would help us identify the difference between a tax and a fee. Because this isn't a fee like I pay for a parking spot, where I pay, I get.
Mm-hmm.
And how much each company pays and the relationship of that to how much they're going to get back in benefit is at least much less clear to me and much less direct. Some may get more, some may get less. And so I don't have a sense for something to be a fee. What evidence do you need to show of is it generic benefit to the industry, or is it that each is the definition of covered carriers here ensure that at least they get some benefit from that, even if it isn't in proportion to what they're paying, or how does that work out?
I think, again, going to the court's discussion of this issue of rural cellular too, carriers benefit from the network effects of the expansion of the network. Their services, regardless of how much they're actually paying into the Universal Service Fund, they benefit from a wider network where more people are on the internet, where more people are on the telephone network. Their service becomes more valuable. And I think that's the, in this context anyway, that's the way you can distinguish between a fee and a tax.
Congress made that finding, or the FCC did? Or does it, we not need a finding?
The court made that finding, actually, but in discussing this issue in rural cellular too.
Did you guys argue it? Do you have a factual basis for it? I'm just trying to figure out where it came from.
Well, I think we did make the argument that that again, and this was, I suppose, this is the basic theory of universal service, that carriers benefit from not just consumers benefit, but carriers benefit from a broader network because their service becomes more valuable. The more people you have in the network, the more valuable your service is.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Carr, we'll give you 3 minutes. And that's right. Now, Mr. Carr, Mr. Gelson, I apologize, Mr. Gelson.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate the time. I'd like to just add a few observations in response. The product service distinction, I'm not sure that the SEC has ever adopted that before. I would be surprised to know that the FCC would disclaim the ability, for example, to provide cell phones to facilitate telecommunications services.
Is there a definition in the statute of telecommunications service?
It's a pretty flexible definition, Your Honor.
Where is that definition?
I believe it's in section 251. Sorry, 53.
Do you know what you don't happen to have what it says, do you?
I could grab it for you if you'd like. I don't have it. I didn't bring that for rebuttal.
Yeah. Of course it's okay.
Sorry to bother you.
No, you're.
I have it if you want it.
Okay, that's okay. I'll hear it.
I think if my clerk's right, it means the offering of telecommunications for a fee directly to the public or to such classes of users as to be effectively available directly to the public, regardless of the facilities used.
Is telecommunications defined?
That's the definition of telecommunications service.
And then telecommunications is... Sorry, I'll figure this out later. You go ahead.
I think the important point here is that the FCC won't disclaim the ability to tax internet streaming services. Like this definition is incredibly broad and malleable. And even if telecommunications services somehow did limit the area in which the FCC could roam free, the Supreme Court's decision in Panama refining forecloses that as an escape from a non-delegation challenge. That case was limited to hot oil, which is significantly more narrow than here, and yet the Supreme Court still found...
This is something we do. Right? We could look at a statute that says service. We could whip out our dictionaries and look at service and product and see how they're defined and figure out whether service includes equipment or not. If it hadn't been treated that way for 90 years, it would suddenly turn into equipment. It's an individualized property equipment as opposed to wires under the ground.
Even if telecommunication services...
The court could do that. I mean, there's a principle here that not only would be intelligible to the FCC, but enforceable by a court. Now, maybe the answer would be, in fact, Congress said something that suggests that it is cell phones or not, whatever. That would be Congress's choice subject to statutory interpretation, right? We'd have to decide that Congress said that. We'd be able to do that, right?
If this court could interpret telecommunication services, yes, I agree.
It's not including, maybe not, I mean, I haven't done the statutory interpretation inquiry, but it is something that courts could review and determine whether products, individualized products are in or out, correct?
This court could do that review.
Right. And we have to still ensure that something that's a substantial number of consumers are signed up for and that and that telecommunications provider provide in their public systems.
The problem is that once you get into the definition of universal service and universal service principles, the principles are listed in precatory language, that they're all couched in should, and that multiple courts have held that they are vague and aspirational.
I think it's respectfully not very true. So it says they shall follow those principles, right? And your argument is essentially they're non-binding guidance to the FCC. But by my count, we've got three courts of appeals that have actually remanded to the FCC for violating either the equitable and non-discriminatory requirement, the affordability requirement, or the sufficiency requirement. And every one of those cases and us in the rural cellular cases treat those as legal requirements that the FCC has to follow. How is your argument reconcilable with those decisions?
So I have 2 points. The first one is that most of the remands were for failure to adequately explain the decision-making.
Topic one says it is contrary to the statute to impose this scheme on ComSat because it was not equitable and non-discriminatory. That is an enforceable legal limit, right?
Even if there is some enforceable legal limit, like there still has to be clear delineations. And the best analogs for this case are going to be Panama Refining and Schecter Poultry, where even if you can find some limits, when the executive is given the ability to balance and weigh multiple vague provisions that allow them to roam free in a field of legislative responsibility.
Why is the best comparison Whitman? So there, it's an incredibly broad delegation, the EPA, to determine air quality standards that are requisite to public health. And what the court essentially said is requisite means enough, but not too much. And you don't need determinate criteria. And here we've got sufficient, yet rates must remain affordable. Why isn't that sort of a direct analogy?
The first distinction is that in this case, we have a whole list of factors and that, for example, Alenco and a few other courts have said that if an agency wants to disregard one in favor of the other, as long as they explain it, they can disregard some of these principles. So it's not like that there is one determinate criteria. It's the agency's ability to pick and choose between those principles in any given case. That's what makes it more like Schecter Poultry and Panama Refining than it does at Whitman. The other distinction is that in Whitman, the limitation that it's enough but no more than necessary came from a definition provided by the Solicitor General during oral argument. The FCC has never claimed that sufficient says enough but no more. In fact, they undercollect and they overcollect, and they've been sued by carriers for not raising enough.
It's certainly not a determinate amount, but what the court has said over and over, cases like Whitman and others, is that you can leave a measure of discretion so long as there are guiding principles. And it seems to me that sufficient levels and keeping rates affordable in the ways we said in rural cellular are telling the agency what to do to a sufficient extent. And I think what was very clear in Whitman was the court was saying there's still a lot of area for judgment here, and that's okay. It seems like you're imposing a much stricter test here.
I would point to the government's own point that this situation, that this statute is unique. There hasn't been anything like this since Schecter Poultry or Panama Refining. Not only does it have vague standards, which may be sufficient in some of these variegated technical areas, but it has multiple vague standards that the agency is then allowed to pick and choose from. And then it allows the agency to add its own principles and redefine universal service. The fact that something that one standard, as narrowed by the Solicitor General, was sufficient in Whitman is not enough to resolve this case, especially given all those additional considerations.
Does the Federal Reserve not raise money from member banks all over the country, fund services and security programs and things like that?
The Federal Reserve has a fee collection structure.
Is the exact amount prescribed by Congress?
I'm not an expert in the Federal Reserve, and I would be hesitant to delve into that one.
But that one is definitely raising funds from banks, right? Or reserve services.
If Congress had given the Federal Reserve the same discretion that we see here, with no cap or rate, with multiple factors to balance, the ability to redefine the factors, then yes, it would raise an unconstitutional non-delegation problem. But that's not the regime that the Federal Reserve is under. As the government has stated, this is a unique case. The courts have not seen it since the 1930s with Panama Refining and Schecter Poultry.
I've been trying to think through, imagine a regime that has one vague statutory, one vague piece of statutory guidance. And then imagine another regime that has six vague pieces of statutory guidance. Is the latter a more intelligible principle or a less intelligible? You could imagine it's more because there's more guidance. You could also imagine it's less because it's like vagueness to the sixth power. Or maybe it's just equally vague.
In a situation where the agency can pick and choose between vague principles, it's more vague.
Maybe. And I also have been thinking J.W. Hampton and customs versus taxes. I wonder if you could help me think this through. Taxes seem to be quintessentially legislative, domestic taxes. Customs seem both legislative and foreign affairs, which the executive has significant inherent discretion and has traditionally been given and exercises significant discretion in the realm of foreign affairs. Do you think that's a fair distinction between customs and taxes? Or do you think it's an irrelevant one?
Yes, that's a fair distinction.
Why? I mean, just for the reason.
Because in the context of non-delegation, multiple courts, I believe the Supreme Court has recognized that when another entity has independent power in that area, the realm of discretion to delegate authority is broader. The president has authority over foreign affairs, and so the customs context is going to be different. It's the same as, for example, in Lichter, which was a wartime statute. The Congress is the president is the commander-in-chief, has separate authority over wartime affairs. That makes the non-delegation calculus different.
Do you have any court has said that about customs versus taxes?
I don't know a court that has said it about customs specifically.
And you're saying that,
but the principle would extend.
The express constitutional power to execute the laws does not qualify.
The take care clause.
Yeah.
Or the executive power.
The executive power is. Are you saying it has to be like a specific little mentioned one, like the commander in chief power, or foreign affairs, princes, these types of things, or is it the fact there's a constitutional assignment to the executive branch, to the president, to faithfully execute the laws enacted by Congress, which means put them into effect and enforce them, that would count the same as the commander-in-chief role?
The executive power is about enforcing the laws passed by Congress, which is separate from areas where the Supreme Court has recognized that the executive might have its own independent power.
That's where I'm getting confused when you say where the executive has its own independent power. I thought its own independent power included execution of the laws. Is that not right?
The president's power to execute the laws is wholly dependent on Congress passing those laws.
I understand. That's all. I will give you that. But once a law is passed, is the president's authority to execute the law, does that count in the same way that you've said the president's commander-in-chief role or shared foreign relations role does in answer to those questions, or do we don't get to count that?
I don't believe it's the same because the executive.
Is it not the same?
It's because it's wholly dependent upon the statute passed by Congress.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But the ability of the president to conduct a war is wholly dependent on Congress declaring war.
That is a fraught question, but the executive has long maintained for decades that the president has independent authority to engage in hostilities overseas.
To declare war? No.
Not to declare war, but to engage in hostilities overseas. We could get into the technicalities of where that line is, but I mean, recently.
So in fact, that there's shared and there's debates about these lines, it's still a special power for the president in the way that power to execute laws, even though there's some shared responsibility perhaps in executing and figuring out the details of the execution, that's no good.
The execution of the laws when they don't implicate one of the president's separate constitutional powers is bound in a different way by the non-delegation doctrine.
No court has said that. There's absolutely nothing whatsoever in the text of the Constitution that suggests that. That suggests that the commander-in-chief power is greater or more independent, for the reasons we just discussed, than the power to execute and enforce laws. So where are you getting that from?
Courts have been willing to derive certain presidential powers directly from the Constitution. The executive power, the ability to execute the laws, is derived from the ability to execute the laws is necessarily derivative from a statute passed by Congress. Therefore, the courts must look specifically to that statute.
So our special power to interpret statutes really isn't all that special because it's entirely derivative of Congress passing statute. So that's not really Article 3E enough.
Well, I am not aware of a court ever interpreting a statute that wasn't passed by Congress. And so I think that...
Right, so ours is completely conditional.
Well, the courts have independent authority, have some sort of shared authority over their own procedures, for example.
Well, I think Congress has said we can make rules. The Rules Enabling Act.
I'm sorry, the Rules Enabling Act?
Yeah, that's our procedures and rules. Are you talking about common law?
I worry that we're getting far afield.
Well, I'm just trying to understand. You seem to think you were embracing a distinction here within the Article II power that I'm just trying to understand if there's any historical, precedential, or textual hook for it. And it sounds like no.
I think that the Supreme Court has multiple times recognized that, like, for example, wartime statutes are different than other statutes. The easiest way to look at this, like the Youngstown tripartite distinction about when the president can act, distinguishes when the president has independent powers versus when it's...
I think this all started with your argument that somehow this being characterized as a tax would make the analysis different, right? And isn't this as simple as reading Skinner, where it says, we hold that there is no difference?
The best reading of Skinner is that the non-delegate...
Imagine this court writing an opinion that says, when the Supreme Court said... quote, we hold that the delegation of discretionary authority under Congress's taxing power is subject to no constitutional scrutiny greater than that we have applied to other non-delegation challenges. What does the next sentence say? That the Supreme Court described that as a holding, but... that wasn't really that important in that case. I just don't think we can do that.
So Skinner did not purport to overrule NCTA. It said that they would be read consistent. NCTA said that using the term public interest in raising revenue raised constitutional issues. Skinner did not purport to overrule cases like Mistretta that said that the scope of permissible delegations depends on context. And so while we may apply the same test here, and while the court may characterize it as stricter or not stricter, the fact is whenever Congress has been faced with a statute like this, closest analogs, they said it wasn't sufficient. And in the cases where there has been revenue raising, a common theme is that there is some sort of objective limitation to stop those delegations. It would be the first time courts have sanctioned an unrestricted raising of revenues.
Other than Lichter.
Lichter was a wartime statute again.
Some of the discussion has been about, I think, a distinction between carrier equipment, like the wires under the ground, and customer equipment, which maybe wouldn't be able to be covered under the Universal Service Fund. Do you know of any examples where the FCC has covered customer equipment under Universal Service? Maybe there are none. Maybe it's statutorily prohibited.
I don't have an answer for that for you at the moment.
Any question?
Judge Garcia, in response to your Lichter question, Lichter was also individualized determinations. It wasn't a broad rule. It wasn't legislative in nature. What the executive was doing, they were determining specific contracts on a case-by-case adjudicatory basis. It's not the same. If Your Honor, if I may have 30 seconds to respond to two things which were asked earlier. Judge Walker, you asked about, and Judge Garcia, you asked about the regulations governing USAC. I would just point the court to language in topic two. It's on page 328, that identifying a precise amount is an imprecise exercise. Like whatever USAC is doing, whatever guidance they've been given, there's still discretion in that area. In addition, again, I would just emphasize that the Supreme Court's been pretty clear the most telling indication of a severe constitutional problem is the lack of historical precedent. This hasn't been seen since Schechter Poultry and Panama Refining, and those delegations were unconstitutional. We would ask the court to vacate the contribution factor for the second quarter of 2023.
Okay. Any questions? Great. Thank you very much. The case is submitted.